Seek out a cave by the ocean while you wait out the rain. Dial down the weak bits and crank up the gain. That's the Mountain Goats. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. The Jays had to sit through a pair of rain delays in Chicago on Tuesday. Game getting started a little later. And then in the middle of the ninth inning, an hour and 8 minute rain delay, all just for Tim Mazza to come back out, throw seven pitches, wrap up the 7-2 victory. The Toronto Blue Jays now, and get ready to hang the banner here, one win away from their first sweep of the season if they can get it done at 7:40 tonight as Alek Manoah takes on Chris Flexen and the White Sox. So, yeah, another win, another exactly what you're supposed to do kind of game against a very bad White Sox team. Doesn't mean you don't get credit for doing it. The bats continue to come around a little bit. I say a little bit because while they did score seven runs, and they have done the six plus runs thing more in the last nine games than they did in like the first 45, they also went 4-for-17 with runners in scoring position, left 14 men on base, and tied a 47-year-old franchise record that goes back to the expansion 1977 season by not scoring in the first inning for a 20th consecutive game. And get this, they lead the entire major leagues in second inning scoring. Figure this team out day to day. We try. No luck so far through one third of the season. It is officially the one third mark. The Jays sit at 25-29. They are four games under 500, last in the AL East, 11 games back of the Yankees, five back of the final wildcard spot. Don't need to update that stuff every day, but because it's the one third mark, it is a nice kind of clean snapshot to take a look. Jays on pace for 75 wins. They'll have to play at something like a 95 win pace the rest of the way to be firmly back in that wild card picture. A lot to talk about from that game, from a pregame transaction where Eric Swanson was optioned down to AAA to make room for Chad Green getting activated off the injured list and to set up the final game of this series. Let's bring in our pal, Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic, who, Caitlin, the Toronto Blue Jays, not the only people having to play through some tough rain the last couple of days. You completed a half marathon on the weekend. How was it? How are you feeling?
Yeah, thank you. Feeling fine, which is actually progress. I feel like that means that I trained really well. But yeah, I don't recommend doing your first half marathon in like torrential downpours and steady rain throughout. That was tough. I hadn't really trained in bad weather, so maybe that was a mistake on my part. I was really banking on just like, you know, perfect running weather to get me through. That didn't happen. But now I feel more prepared than ever to do another one. I know what happens when everything goes wrong and you're racing in poor conditions. So hopefully the next time I do one, the conditions will be better.
Well, congratulations on completing your first half marathon. That's a huge thing, obviously. I know you're working hard on it. Blue Jays working hard here to scrape back to 500. Couple of wins down in Chicago here. And yeah, the White Sox are the worst team in the league. Pedro Grifol is calling them out heading into this series. Obviously, though, coming out of that Tiger series, all you can really do is kind of put one in front of the other and get rolling here. Obviously no one's going to celebrate two wins against the White Sox, but what have you seen the last two games compared to, you know, where we were at kind of on Monday morning?
Yeah, I mean, it, like you said, it's important to win the games you're supposed to win. And I think that there's been instances throughout the season where the Blue Jays haven't been able to do that. You know, just this past weekend against the Tigers, you had some winnable games. You had a game where you really made an impressive comeback, only to let that slip away. Earlier in the year, I'm thinking of a series against the Washington Nationals, where, again, those were sort of winnable games that you let slip through your fingers. And so it's good to go into Chicago and face a obviously very bad White Sox team and be able to win those games. It's got to start somewhere. I think the Blue Jays know the hole they've dug themselves in. They know that, you know, it's really going to be a challenge for them to make the postseason, get back into contention. Like you said, you're looking at somewhere in the range of like anywhere from like a 92 to 96 win pace for them to sort of feel comfortable that they could eke into the wild card. And that's no guarantee, but, you know, just looking at where the standings are right now, that's what it would take. that's pretty far off from the pace that the club has played with to this point, obviously. You know, it's not impossible. Baseball is weird. You can see teams really turn it on in the second half. The Blue Jays traditionally have been more of a second half team. You know, I think it was 2022. Where they really made a push in the second half. And they did, you know, have a very impressive winning pace if you look back at, like, their splits in the first half and second half of that year. But in that year, it was something like, you know, Bo really turned it on, and they had guys really step up. And so that's what it will take for them to, you know, have a second half where they really are in contention. And, you know, you see a guy like Vlad, who's hitting the ball really well, still not hitting for power quite yet. So you want that to come a little bit, but yeah, I mean, let's see if they get the sweep. That would be an accomplishment. What, we're at the end of May and they still haven't had a sweep, so that, you know, check that off the list hopefully, and start to you know, then go back home and see what you can do against the Pirates.
A Pirates team, by the way, if you are just a general baseball fan, maybe you're sad to miss out on Jared Jones and Paul Skenes on the weekend. Tune in this afternoon. It's Jared Jones and Paul Skenes in a doubleheader down at Detroit, which is, man, if you've got tickets for that doubleheader, can't imagine a cooler stack of pitching. Tarik Skubal on the other side for the Tigers as well. So, yeah, the Jays have a chance to get it rolling here. That's not a great Pirates team. This is obviously not a very good White Sox team. And they have been hitting a little bit better lately. They didn't, you know, there were the two games on the weekend where they didn't really get it done. But they have scored six or more runs, I think five times in the last nine games. Mike Petriello was talking on Blue Jay Central last night that they're the number two team by OPS over the last, I think, 10 days in Major League Baseball, which is a small window, but it's all small windows right now. Kind of in take what you can get mode with this team as well. Is it as simple as, you know, in terms of what has clicked offensively? You know, this is the first time in a long time we've seen Vlad, Bo, and Dalton Varsho all hitting well at the same time. Like, is that too much of an oversimplification, Caitlin?
Well, I mean, it does start there. Like, you have to have your guys at the top of the order, you know, hitting well. You have Davis Schneider that's really settled into that leadoff spot as well. Obviously, he's been hitting well all season long, but, you know, it feels like after a long time, the lineup feels a bit more optimized, and then you have actually guys hitting while they're in those positions. And I think early on, the team was talking about, you know, some bad luck, and, you know, they like some things that their hitters were doing. If you look at sort of underlying stats, like, you know, walks, pitches seen, you know, the Blue Jays are doing a good job. I think it's, you know, the Sean Schneider and the team have been talking about, you know, their at bats being good. And that was something that they didn't really have much to show for it early on. And so maybe you're starting to see that turn a little bit, and some of those good at bats where they're seeing a lot of pitches, or they're swinging at pitches they should be swinging at. And finally those they're doing damage on those balls. So I think maybe there's a chance that we're just seeing things correct a little bit. I think that maybe we'll talk about this later, and it just comes down to this team, like, clicking all at once. I think that we've seen some games, again, to reference the Detroit series, where, yeah, the bats came alive and they came back in a game, but then your bullpen kind of blows up and they're giving up nine runs, and Yimi Garcia is giving up a run for the first time in a month and a half or whatever it was. So, yeah, like, I think that, you know, getting the offense where it needs to be is step one, but then it's all about having this team play their best brand of baseball, and that includes pitching well, and it includes, obviously, guys coming in relief and pitching well, too.
Yeah, and look, we've seen versions of this team over the last couple of years where the starting pitching is going well and the hitting's going well. You know, the bullpen was a strength the last 2 years, but maybe not all the way where it needed to be other than those very back-end guys. It's, you know, it's unusual that you get all those things rolling at once. But if we look at the teams that do well in the postseason year over year, there's usually at least one stretch of time during the season where they do have all those things clicking. You know, everyone gets a turn. You know, the Phillies have looked like the best team in baseball for a bit this year. Cleveland has, the Yankees have, Baltimore have. Every, you know, it's that doesn't mean you're the best team in baseball, but you should have that capability to at least put it together for a little bit if we're going to have faith that you can make something happen in the playoffs and make the playoffs in the Jays' case. The other thing with the offense having turned around the last 10 days or whatever is they have played Tampa Bay, Chicago, Detroit, Chicago, and they have missed some of the best starters on those teams. So that's probably a component of this as well. But, Caitlin, you mentioned someone who this isn't a small sample size for. Since debuting last August, Davis Schneider has a 156 weighted runs created plus. So his offense has been 56 percent better than a league average hitter. That is ninth in all of baseball since he debuted. And the names ahead of him are all perennial all-stars in Mookie Betts, Aaron Judge, Shohei, Trey Turner, Bryce Harper, Juan Soto, Kyle Tucker. And I guess the one name that wouldn't be, you know, maybe not all-star status because he's so hot and cold is Marcell Ozuna. But those are the names. Those are the only names ahead of David Schneider since he debuted. And he hasn't played every single day since then, but he is this year and now seems to be getting into a groove as the leadoff hitter as well. And you mentioned, Caitlin, some of the things John Schneider has liked about this offense, even when the runs weren't there. Hey, are you working long plate appearances? Are you making good swing decisions? Are you swinging at what you can do damage on? David Schneider has kind of been the guy who's been doing that all along. Three hits, a walk, and a sac fly yesterday. Have you liked David Schneider in the leadoff spot over the last week or two since he got the bump there?
Yeah, I really have. And he really sneakily kind of profiles really well as probably more of like a modern day leadoff hitter, in the sense that I think the broadcast was talking about it yesterday, where I can't remember exactly where he is on the list, but he's near the top of the list in terms of pitches seen per plate appearance. So that was something that John Schneider always talked about with David Schneider, is that, you know, one of the reasons why they put him in the leadoff spot, beyond just the fact that he has been one of their best hitters, is the fact that he always gives you a good at bat. And they sort of had confidence in the fact that he wasn't going to change his approach. He wasn't going to get unnerved by moving up in the lineup, by hitting off leadoff. I think realistically, when you're in the leadoff position, your only sort of different at bat would be the first one, because you know it's going to be the first one. After that, you know, the game is just getting rolling and you're just coming up when your turn comes up. But I think the Blue Jays had a lot of confidence in the fact that David Schneider, you know, has a reputation now, even though he's still fairly young in the league, is, you know, not getting too high, not getting too low. You know, he doesn't seem fazed by any situation. And so I think they had a lot of faith that he could go up in the leadoff spot and not really change a thing, just do what you've been doing best. And what he does best is he swings at good pitches. He knows what pitches he can do damage on. He sees a lot of pitches, you know, he's patient, he waits. And if he needs to take a walk, he'll take a walk. So I think he does a lot of good things. And I mean, he's a well-rounded hitter too. So I think overall, I really liked him in the leadoff spot. I think the Blue Jays have honestly maybe uncovered a guy that they could use in years to come, just depending on, you know, what the future holds for George Springer, and where he will fit in the lineup, you know, going forward.
Yeah, and you mentioned the pitches per plate appearance, that he's top 10. I think he was seventh yesterday. I didn't update the stats this morning. One other positive before we address some of the tougher decisions the Jays have made and will continue to have to make here. I don't want to lower the bar too much, but Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has a 725 OPS so far. I think I probably owe him like a slight my bad. I like Isaiah Kiner-Falefa as a guy to talk to. The reputation on him was very strong as a clubhouse guy. But this is a guy who came in here where, you know, a 699 OPS back 4 years ago in the short pandemic season, like that was the career high with the bat. He has given the Blue Jays a little bit more with the bat than maybe we expected. Even if that comes down to earth, you hear other guys talk about him in really glowing fashion about what he is, you know, you hear like, oh, he's a baseball player, he's a gamer, et cetera, a lot. What have you made of IKF's fit with the Blue Jays these first 2 months?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's probably exceeded expectations in terms of his offense. It's been a little bit up and down, but he's been as solid as you want him to be the last little bit. He's been one of their better swinging bats, obviously swinging in the bottom half of the lineup. But like when you're a guy in the bottom half, you're just trying to move things along. And like, yeah, he came into this team with a reputation as a guy, he's not going to hit for a ton of power, but he's going to be able to rack up singles. He's going to be able to get on base, you know, move guys along, push guys over on the bases. He has good speed. He does a lot of things really well. I think that he's fit in really well with the team. You talk a little bit about the guy he is in the clubhouse, you know, pretty quiet but very friendly, kind of just goes about his business. You kind of see him always walking around the same time, coming from the weight room, going to the field, getting all his work in. I think that, you know, the Blue Jays have been pretty consistent with his defensive positioning too, which is probably, you know, he's a guy that can play all over the field. He has played all over the field. I think first base is the only position he hasn't played in a major league game. And And so I think that probably it helps him, even though he can move around and do a lot of things for you. I think they've sort of just kept him in the infield, which is a place where he's comfortable. He's comfortable at third, comfortable at second base. And so maybe the fact that he hasn't had to move around a ton defensively has just helped his offense a little bit. Doesn't have to sort of get in a ton of pregame work at all the different positions. So that is probably helpful for him too. But yeah, I think that you know, I understand, you know, why fans were a little curious about this signing, or it wasn't exactly sort of the big move that they were hoping for in the offseason. You know, that's not really IKF's fault. He's going to take the money from the team that offers it to him. So, but I think when you look at what he's done and what the Blue Jays realistically expected from him, I think that he's basically exceeded those expectations. I think that he's been, you know, everything that you would want him to be for a guy that's hitting in the bottom of your lineup.
I can't wait for this type of terminology to bleed over into like how we talk about our media peers. Just like, oh, Caitlin's just a baseball writer. That's but complimentary, not derogatory. Like the word just can be such a like derogatory qualifier or such a complimentary qualifier. Anyway, let's turn to So IKF, you know, so far. I can still disagree with the you know, with the contract relative to the market and opportunity costs and things like that, but he's been really, really solid for this team. Some of the other additions that they made in the offseason have not. The designated hitter position has been a tough one. Justin Turner has been able to hit really well against lefties, but has not hit right-handed pitching at all. He's in like a 3-for-45 or something like that drought heading into last night, where he did pick up a hit and a walk last night, came up with two RBI. But that Turner, Vogelbach, DH platoon has really struggled. There is, you know, a partial answer to that if they decided that Vogelbach's, you know, hey, that's another guy, a lot of pitches per plate appearance, hits the ball hard, even though the results aren't there, really well liked in the clubhouse. That's an easier decision to make if it comes to that, I think. With respect to Justin Turner, how do you think they handle kind of scaling back his playing time maybe here while he tries to figure it out?
Yeah, I mean, the Blue Jays are in somewhat of a tough spot because they don't have any great alternatives. They have alternatives, but doesn't seem like anything is overwhelmingly attractive. I think that, you know, overall the offense hasn't performed very well. So even if it's getting a little bit better, like there's not a lot of other bench options that you're turning to that could hit the DH position. So, you know, I think the Blue Jays, one thing that has been mentioned about Justin Turner is that he did come down with that viral illness that was passing through the team earlier this month. He seems to get it really hard. And so, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't know how long it would take somebody, or especially a professional athlete that has to perform, you know, at the top of their physical level to recover from an illness like that. Certainly he looks like he's feeling better, but I don't know if it takes a couple of weeks for the body to recover, depending on how bad he was feeling, or maybe, you know, you really get out of the rhythm. Obviously he was performing really well in April, so you know, like the potential is there, the bat is still there, but it's now been about a month of him really struggling at the plate. And so, yes, maybe looking at the illness as somewhat of an excuse or a crutch. I think you can't use it too much longer, but maybe just that caveat in there, you know, you wonder if he can come out of it with just more, a few more consistent at bat. So maybe the Blue Jays are trying to get him back into that rhythm. You know, maybe you look at down in AAA and there's some guys that you could look at, but Aurelvis Martinez, while he swings the bat really well and he hits home runs, he does a lot of things that the Blue Jays need. You know, the Blue Jays are probably not ready to close the book on him defensively. He obviously needs a lot of work at second base or just in the infield in general. And so if they call him up, he's not getting maybe as consistent playing time in the field. And so that's not great for his development. He's still a really young player and with hopefully a long future ahead of him. And a guy like Spencer Horwitz, who I think you're talking to later, maybe you can ask him about it. But I mean, I think that's also the thing with him is I think they want him to get defensive work. They've been playing him a little bit at second. He can play left field. He can play first base. And so I think they like the fact that he can get a lot of playing time in Buffalo. And if you call him up and he's DHing here, again, he's losing out on some of that defensive development that a guy like him would need. And so it's a tough position for the Blue Jays. How much longer can you ride out Justin Turner? How much longer can you hope that he can turn things around? Probably a little bit longer. You know, he's a guy with a track record. You know, I don't think he had this big of a dip last year with Boston. I think he was pretty steady and consistent with Boston up until maybe the end of the season when, you know, basically Boston's out of it. And so that's concerning to me. You mentioned not hitting righties very well. You know, but the Blue Jays just don't have a great alternative. I don't know that they're there to, they're there at the point where they really need to switch things up. Again, like a Joey Votto, also, like, we kind of don't know what's going on with him. Long recovery for that ankle sprain. So it's a tough spot for the Blue Jays. I think that, you know, we've seen them, and maybe we'll talk about this next with Eric Swanson, like, we've seen them now make some pretty urgent moves. So they're probably not too far away from having to do something with Justin Turner or really cutting down his playing time, but maybe not quite there yet.
Yeah, and it helps when other guys are hitting. You can kind of, you know, slide him lower in the order, and similar to George Springer going down to the seventh spot. If Vlad and Bo and Varsho and David Schneider and Danny Jansen, if everyone's hitting, you can let that can skate by a little bit. You can give a guy a little bit more patience. When nobody's hitting, all those things look really, really bad. You mentioned Eric Swanson. That was the other tough thing from yesterday. Obviously, a guy who, again, like Turner, like Vogelbach, like IKF, has a big clubhouse value. He's really well liked among the relief corps. He has had a very tough year going back to his child being in the hospital during spring training, an IL stint, and now a 9.22 ERA. The Jays decided to option him to AAA yesterday to make room for Chad Green. I'd imagine that was a difficult conversation. How tough a decision do you think that was for the Blue Jays versus, you know, hey, Pearson or Pop or Hennessy Cabrera are the more typical guys you'd option in a situation like that?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, he's a huge presence in the bullpen, not just for like the talent, the performance that he had last year, but just his personality. He's looked at, you know, as one of the leaders in the bullpen, you know, a guy that has experience, you know, pitching in a lot of high leverage situations, kind of has seen a lot in his major league career, has gone through a lot in his major league career. He's, you know, faced this sort of adversity when it comes to performance before, and he did kind of remake himself into a reliever using that splitter that kind of saved his career. And so, you know, this year not getting the performance, not getting the results that the Blue Jays typically would rely on from him. And I think that, yes, you kind of talked about the tough year that he's had and just really hasn't been able to get into that good rhythm. He's not just seeing the type of success on, you know, his best pitches, not locating the ball, not executing the ball as well as he normally can. And so I think the decision, you know, for the Blue Jays, it underlines kind of how important he is for them in the sense that, you know, they would rather take the time for him to get right, then maybe make the easier or like probably more straightforward path of maybe just optioning in a guy that has already been in the minors this year, like a Nate Pearson or a Zach Pop. But I think the Blue Jays really value Eric Swanson and want him to get right. And I think that the best way for him to do that is to pitch in, you know, less pressure packed situations in the minor leagues. He can get in there more consistently. They can find spots for him to pitch. Whereas the Blue Jays probably were being very careful and selective with where they want to put him. So if you can't use him very consistently, and the best thing for him is to get consistent outings, you know, sending him to AAA was a logical move. So you can see why the Blue Jays did it. It's tough, but it also sort of just underlines a bigger point in that, you know, they are playing with a lot of urgency right now. They just simply do not have the time for someone to work through their issues on the mound in games that they are more or less playing must-win games at this point, or, you know, every series, every winnable series and every series is kind of a must-win series from here on out if they need to play at the pace they need to play at. And, you know, I think that the pitching just hasn't been good enough, and I think that if they can find ways to try to improve that, they're going to take every measure necessary, even difficult ones.
Yeah, you're right. They're not only just winning series, but taking advantage of this White Sox situation, a Pittsburgh team without their two best arms. Yeah, you've got three against Oakland in June, but otherwise the June schedule is hell. it's nothing but top teams and AL East teams. So other than that one athletic series where you're on the West Coast too and weird things happen. So yeah, in the words of IKF last night, we're excited and we're ready to go on a run. Let's hope that is the case. Caitlin, different kind of run. You break now? Like, are you done or are you pushing to a full marathon?
Not a full marathon. Okay. I did sign up for another half in October. So it's a bit of a break right now and just kind of focusing on, I don't know, having fun running and going fast and trying to like improve my speed. And then as we get closer to midsummer, I'll probably start working back towards distance.
Nice. You're working up. This is spring training for you, kind of a reset here. Caitlin, thanks so much for taking the time out. Congrats again on your first half marathon.
Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure you're checking out all her great work over there. And yeah, she promoted this show better than I did. I always forget to give the guest rundown off the start. I tweeted out. But Spencer Horwitz is going to be on with us later. He's going to join us around 11:30. Buffalo Bisons first baseman / DH / left fielder / second baseman / top 10 in basically every stat category in AAA baseball. We'll also have Mike Petriello of MLB.com on. And after we take a break here, we're going to talk to John Morosi of MLB Network. He reported this morning that the Jays have expressed some interest in Ryan McMahon, Colorado Rockies second baseman / third baseman, left-handed hitter, a little bit of pop that could maybe, you know, certainly on paper in the offseason look like a guy who would make some sense for this team. Owed a decent amount of money from here through 2027, but the Jays, you know, potentially have some flexibility there. So we'll talk to John Morosi about that Ryan McMahon interest and whip around all of baseball a little bit. John Morosi, Mike Petriello, Spencer Horwitz later in the show as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays with another win yesterday around a couple of delays. That made the game line up nicely with not only Game 4 of the NBA Western Conference Finals, but also Game 4 of the NHL Conference Finals, where the Panthers and Rangers went to OT. Our next guest was all over that one because he's at MLB Network and NHL Network. It's John Morosi. John, good morning. How we doing, man? How are you enjoying the Stanley Cup playoffs here?
Loving it, Blake. Good morning to you. I was also keeping one eye on a great matchup in the Memorial Cup here in my home state of Michigan. Drummondville against Moose Jaw. Moose Jaw scoring shorthanded late to secure their spot in the semifinal. So there are so many great games going on right now in both of my favorite sports that I'm not even really sure night to night what to do.
And if I understand it right, your Saginaw Spirit can punch their ticket to the Memorial Cup final with a W tonight or a win in the semifinals, if not?
You are on it, my friend. Yeah, so right now you've got an unbeaten Saginaw and an unbeaten London with Leafs prospect Easton McCowan starring all the way in the Memorial Cup. They match up tonight, and that is a big rivalry here in the great state of Michigan and, of course, in Ontario as well, Saginaw versus London. So the winner goes straight to Sunday's final. The loser will meet Moose Jaw Friday in the demi-finale. So very excited about how things are playing out right now.
So that's in Saginaw, about an hour and a half down the road in Detroit. On the weekend, we saw Jays Tigers, not a great series for the Blue Jays, and just kind of a chaotic weekend. We had that one game on the Thursday with the power outage. You ever seen anything like that, John?
There was a lot going on.
Yeah. Like,
there was a lot going on during that weekend in so many different ways. And you said it about how that Sunday game played out. 14-11. And yes, by the time I got to the rink, because I was at the Mem Cup that day, all the folks from Ontario who are in Saginaw right now, I just saw a lot of head shaking after the way that game unfolded. And listen, that was a game where the offense got going. It looked as though Varsho had saved the day and Biggio had saved the day. And then, of course, it all unraveled against the Jays bullpen, which, of course, they've since changed out some personnel. Chad Green back, Swanson down in the minor leagues. Romano a rare blown save when you think about how reliable he's been for the last several years when in context of the big picture here. So it really is, I think, a crucial stretch for the Jays, as we all know. The last couple of days have been encouraging in Chicago. And by the way, they're supposed to be. You're supposed to sweep the White Sox. I think the big scoreboard, though, I think for me, Blake, is not just this series against Chicago, but you have to loop it into last week's series against the White Sox, the weekend against Detroit. And at the moment, they're one game over 500 in this stretch. And this is supposed to be the stretch where you really get healthy and you really start to boost that record and get closer to 500. So I'm going to watch carefully to see this game tonight and then on the weekend against the Pirates and then see what kind of momentum the Jays can bring beyond that in terms of the next couple of weeks.
And not only teams that are a little lower in the standings, but like, yeah, we can acknowledge the Tigers have been fun. They're hanging around 500. You missed Tarik Skubal. You saw Garrett Crochet in the last White Sox series, but you're missing him this series. You're going to miss Jared Jones and Paul Skeens on the weekend. Like, this is not even the best version of this Tigers team, this White Sox team, this Pirates team. So, John, if things don't go well, if the Blue Jays can't pull them out of this, and I want to be positive because they won two in a row, there's a possibility where things correct, and by mid-June, we're talking about this team differently. If they don't, how early do you think other teams would start circling the Jays and looking at some of the guys who could maybe hit free agency this winter and think, hey, maybe we'll call the Jays on being a seller instead of a buyer?
I think we're probably a couple weeks away from that, Blake. And I think you're correct to assess that this team is a bubble team with respect to the trade deadline. Now, the two of us might be able to look at this and say, what evidence do we see that they should be a buyer? And that's a fair question to ask. But the context of all this is very real. We know the year one of the great renovations at Rogers Center, it's going to be difficult 2 months into this to then start selling off your best players when you made a big investment in the infrastructure and tickets are priced as they are. I just don't see that being a very viable path unless things completely unravel. And I'll say this, if things completely unravel, there are two ways in which we're looking at this. One is the Jays are out of it for this year, which would mean that the likes of Kikuchi or Jimmy Garcia, certainly a Justin Turner would be in play for the trade deadline. That's one avenue. The total rebuild would be if Vlad and Bo become part of the conversation. And to be honest, I don't see that happening unless A, things get really bad, and B, unless it's someone who's not Ross Atkins making that decision. I think the only way that Vlad and Bo are in play at the deadline is if it is a complete changeover. And to be honest, Blake, the amount of time for that to happen is short. Because if you're looking at trading Vlad or Bo, that is a foundational, organizational changing decision. And if you're going to look at who the next person is to make that decision, unless it's James Click, who's already part of the organization, which I suppose is one very specific case. But if it's not James Click, and you as an organization believe that you need to trade Vlad or Bo to do a total rebuild, and if you believe that Ross Atkins is not the person to do that, you probably have to make that decision yesterday and have a full exhaustive search for the new person to then make that decision. And this is all less than 2 months away. In terms of due diligence on finding the person to make that decision and then allowing the person enough time to make that decision, that's a lot of time and a lot of exhaustive evaluations that have to go on. So I think, Blake, these are two vastly different decisions. Either you trade the guys who are going to be free agents after this season, which is a logical thing to do and something that I believe Ross Atkins is capable of doing. But if you go down the line of the guys who are not free agents until after 2025, specifically Vlad and Bo, that is a next level decision that I think probably can't happen if Ross Atkins is still at the controls.
And John, I think you could make a pretty reasonable argument that even a minor selling a retooling for 2025 maybe shouldn't be the same decision makers who got them into this spot as well. That's maybe a conversation for 2 weeks from now if things have gotten a little worse. There's another scenario here, too, where, you know, one of two ways the Jays get to being buyers, and that's they turn things around a little bit and they realize they're still, hey, they got to play at a 97 win pace from here to get the last year's win total. Even if you turn things around, maybe you need some help to get all the way back. Or things are so bad that they can't wait for the trade deadline. They need to try to make an addition now, maybe to save a job, maybe to save a season. You reported earlier on Twitter that the Jays, and this is no surprise, we've kind of kicked this name around before, you and I, me and some other people here at Sportsnet, Ryan McMahon would be of interest, not just to the Blue Jays, but to a lot of teams. That's a 29-year-old lefty, some positional versatility, having a nice offensive season for the Rockies, under control through 2027. So you put out there that the Jays have some interest in Ryan McMahon, but at this point, the Rockies are at least playing the we're not trading Ryan McMahon card. How much of that is May 29th posturing versus the Rockies would actually ride this out in a clear, like, we're not competitive by 2025, 2026 scenario?
Well, the Rockies do plan to keep Ryan McMahon based on everything that I've been told. He is a favorite of ownership there. And when you think about the club, and first of all, this is an organization that has operated differently than a lot of other teams for a very, very long time. Think about how many years and it took until later on, and it took a very comprehensive trade by Alex Anthopoulos to get it done when they brought in Troy Tulowitzki. But they waited and waited and waited long after teams had been calling for years and years and years to get Tulo before they actually made that trade. And I think that was a very, very specific moment in time where that made sense for the Rockies. Ryan McMahon is their guy. He will be their all-star this season. I think the Rockies caught a lot of criticism for the way in which the Nolan Arenado trade went down. They actually did, in retrospect, pretty well when you think about the way that Gomber has pitched for them. And obviously, Nolan is not really having a typical Nolan season right now for St. Louis. So, in general, I think the Rockies did the best they could with that trade, but still, they've caught a lot of criticism for it. I just don't think the ownership has the appetite to trade another popular player in McMahon, who really is their main gate attraction at the moment, and is, to your point, under control through 2027. He is the guy that everybody's going to be calling about, but I just don't see the Rockies going down that road at this moment in time. I do think the Jays would like to make a move in the near term, not the blockbuster necessarily, not the McMahon move, but even someone like Tommy Pham, who I think is off to a really good start with the White Sox. The Jays, of course, are seeing him right now. He would help the Jays. And the issue I've got with the Jays, there's the short-term issue, and then there's the long-term issue. The long-term issue is this team is one of the older rosters in the American League, and the farm system is not necessarily in the best position. There are some injured pitchers. There's not the high-end impact, aside from Orelvis Martinez right now, that I would say could make a high level of impact in terms of being a foundational core player for a long time to come. The issue in the short term that I've got with this team is that, Blake, and as you watch this team, you probably have the same observation. When it comes to in-game moves or day-to-day moves, it's not the most flexible roster. There are a lot of two-move players. If Vogelbach pinch hits for somebody and gets on base, here comes Kevin Biggio, or here comes another player to pinch run. It's not a very flexible roster, and that's a problem. There are players in the minor leagues right now, whether it's a Horowitz or a Lucas or others, who would probably make this team a little more flexible, a little more usable for John Schneider. I agree that you could certainly argue that John Schneider probably hasn't had the best year of any manager in the American League this season. That's a fair comment. But look at the tools and pieces that he has to work with. He does not have an abundance of athleticism up and down the roster the way that other managers do. This is not the Baltimore Orioles roster. This is not Brandon Hyde's team to work with that John Schneider has right now. And I think it's important to an extent, grade the manager on a curve here and say, what does he really have to work with late in a game, down one, when one of his more reliable bats is one of his catchers? And how often can he have Danny Jansen be his DH? And if he does, what does that mean for the other moves that he can make? And by the way, if you have Jansen as your DH, then you basically have a bench that includes potentially Turner and Vogelbach. Where are you going to put those guys into the game? And so I think it's just, it's a roster that doesn't really work. And that is not the fault of John Schneider.
No, it's not. And it's, they run into a situation last night even where a lefty's come in and Kevin Kiermaier's in the game with the bases loaded and he ends up hitting into a fielder's choice. So not the worst damage in the world, but you're looking at the bench. It's like, well, which 580 OPS guy do you want to come in and pitch it? And you still have to make the best decisions within those confines. But yeah, the bottom part of this roster has not performed particularly well. Similar thing in the bullpen where, can you hang it on the manager for Eric Swanson having an ERA over 9 when he's got 2+ years of being very, very good? Tough one there. I want to pivot outside of Toronto here a little bit, John. Some interesting things going to happen with the Braves, I would imagine. And when we talk about teams that could potentially look to buy early, if the Jays are one of those teams trying to kind of keep it out of the drain, well, the Braves are already very good, but they've dealt with, Austin Riley missing a couple weeks with that weird illness that they wouldn't put him on the IL for, but kept going, or not illness, but the oblique thing. Now Ronald Acuña Jr. out for the season. Are the Braves a team that we could see be a little aggressive early on here, jump the line, kind of like the Padres tried to do with Luis Arraez?
As we know, Blake, Alex Anthopoulos typically does not wait around.
Yeah.
And while the word that I got over the weekend was, well, they're going to stay internal for now. We're going to see a lot of Kelnick and Duvall in the corners and Harrison center. And that's a fine outfield to have. But let's remember, 3 years ago, same GM, after Acuña was lost for the season in July, it took him all of 1 week to trade for Jock Peterson. And then by the time the month was over, he had acquired Adam Duvall, Eddie Rosario, and Jorge Soler. He acquired 4 outfielders, Blake. 4, okay? So that is the track record. We talk about the track record of players, certainly – the more I cover the sport, I look at the track record of owners and GMs. And Alex Anthopoulos' track record says, as Blue Jays fans well know, he is going to make a trade. He will. And again, I've mentioned Tommy Pham as being a good candidate for the Braves as well. Taylor Ward could be a possibility. Brent Rooker in Oakland. We know that Alex makes a lot of deals with Oakland. I think that's a natural fit to look at. So I do believe that the Braves will make a move, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that the Phillies are a much better team than any other ball club in the NL East back in 2021 when the Braves made those 4 additions of outfielders during the course of the season and then went on to win the World Series. So they lost Acuña. He did not play a single game after July the 10th of 2021. And by the end of the season, they were holding the Commissioner's Trophy. So the Braves clearly know how to make some moves. And let's remember, too, they're also trying to make these moves in a year in which they also don't have Spencer Strider. So they are minus Strider. They're minus Acuña. They're still in a strong second-place position. If there's one silver lining for the Atlanta Braves at the moment in the National League East, it's that the Mets are going nowhere. They are really struggling. The Marlins have had a disastrous first half, and the Nationals aren't really ready yet to be a playoff team. I love CJ Abrams, but they're not really in the playoff conversation yet. So in light of that, unless you're going to concede the Phillies are going to win the division, which honestly, they're in pretty good position to do that, the Braves have to look around and say, wait a minute, while the Phillies are getting some distance ahead of us, it's not as though we're about to get passed by the 3 teams behind us. So let's just make sure that we're in a good position. Maybe they'll spend some capital down the line to make sure that they're in a good position to make at least a wild card spot, which, by the way, they are, because you look around and again, I'm not so sure that the other teams in the National League West are going to pass them by. Maybe there's one or two teams in the Central that you're thinking about. So I do think Alex Anthopoulos is his aggressiveness will show up at some point, Blake, but maybe not imminently, simply because they're not really getting pressured from the rest of the National League.
And you can do other aggressive things, like internally promoting Spencer Schwellenbach to start tonight, who started this. I know he's not like a young prospect. He's 24 or about to turn 24 later this week, actually. But he started the season in high A, and he's going to come up and start today. Ridiculous strikeout numbers at double A. What do you make of that? Just a short-term fill-in there, or do they see something in Schwellenbach already? Like this is a guy who was like fringy top 100 prospect, but not really on the, you know, hey, he's going to come in and be in the rotation this year radar.
Right. He's a very interesting guy. He's a college draft from Nebraska. He was actually a two-way player for a while. He has been someone that's had, to your point, high-level prospect status in the past, but missed the time due to injury. So I would look at him as being much more than your regular guy who had started in high A this season. He's been a futures game type guy before. And by the way, from the great city of Saginaw, Michigan, home of the Memorial Cup. How about that to
there you
tie
go.
Them all together? So what a great week for Saginaw in general. Proud graduate of Saginaw Heritage High School. So Schwellenbach, I'm excited to see him show up here in the big leagues and really put his stamp on a rotation spot, because the Braves do need some reinforcements from within. And Alex Anthopoulos has shown in the past they are willing to promote aggressively. Whether Schuster is one example of a guy here in recent years that they've shown the willingness to promote rapidly through the system. Even you go back to Max Fried, didn't have a ton of time in the minor leagues when they brought him up initially. So I think Alex, you think back to even his time with the Jays, Aaron Sanchez didn't have a ton of time in the minor leagues at the time that they promoted him to the big league. So Alex is someone that when he sees someone that's got the right stuff, he will promote them aggressively, and I think that's certainly the case right now with Spencer Schwellenbach.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun to see. Great day for young pitching all around baseball. I know in your neck of the woods, there's a Pirates-Tigers doubleheader that has Jared Jones against Tarik Skubal and then Paul Skeens a little later. So it should be a fun day of baseball. Should be a fun day of Memorial Cup action for you as well, John. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, and best of luck to the Saginaw Spirit.
Oh, I think that this is a budding rivalry now in junior hockey. There was a moment where I was in the building a couple nights ago where someone with a London Knights sweater was there, and they got booed on the Jumbotron. I said, wow, this is going next level now, where the big bad London Knights are rolling into town. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it should be a blast. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Blake. All the best.
John Morosi of MLB Network and NHL Network. Yeah, you know, that's a fun little rivalry there. It's kind of the junior hockey version of when Blue Jays fans try to take over Comerica Park. Yeah, it's fun. I mentioned Jared Jones and Paul Skeens pitching both legs of a doubleheader for the Pirates today in Detroit, which means the Blue Jays won't see them on the weekend. They never lined up, but it was possible. The Pirates don't have a fifth starter right now, so it was possible they could have changed their minds and started one of those guys, likely Jared Jones, on Sunday this weekend. But now both of them are starting today. I can't imagine the Pirates are a team that are going to start a young pitcher on short rest. So the Jays can thank a rain out yesterday for that one. Another note from John that we didn't get to touch on there, but he updated on MLB Network yesterday. If you're keeping an eye on those Dodgers and how that Shohei Ohtani contract looks, not only is he already been worth three wins above replacement as a full-time DH, but he's progressed to throwing from 60 feet, throwing 80 miles an hour, getting 50, 60 tosses in, and he is like fully on track to make a 2025 return to the mound the way things look right now. So pretty cool if you're the Dodgers. Not the best if you missed out on Shohei Ohtani there. For the Jays, it's Alek Manoah against Chris Flexen tonight. We will tee that one up proper a little later, but I'm pretty fascinated to see how Alek Manoah will look in this one. If you think back a couple starts ago, you know, the question with 13 games in 13 days was, well, should you change up Alek Manoah's spot in the rotation so that he catches the White Sox in his second start instead of Tampa Bay? Now, the way things have worked out, he saw Minnesota went pretty well. Saw Tampa Bay, went pretty well. It was a lesser Tigers team that really got to him on the weekend. And I know some misfortune with the defense behind him, but he also gave up a pair of home runs. And that's a Tigers team that was 29th in the league in hitting home runs against right-handed pitching prior to that. So now we'll get to see a look at what would that have looked like with Alek Manoah against the Chicago White Sox lineup. He catches them on the way back. It is a White Sox lineup that, of course, is the worst offense in baseball. They're hitting .215 with a .278 on base percentage and a .329 slugging. I had joked last series that their team stat line is almost identical to Ryan Goins's career slash line. They are now worse than Ryan Goins. So, and I don't mean that as disrespect to Ryan Goins. The White Sox also don't field as slickly as Ryan Goins. Andrew Benintendi's robbing of a home run yesterday notwithstanding. We're going to take a break. On the other side, Mike Petriello and Spencer Horwitz as JSOC Plus continues.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. It's a little dead Kennedys to play our next guest in, Mike Petriello. He needs a second here. So just a reminder, 7:40 start tonight. Alek Manoah, Chris Flexen. We'll talk to Spencer Horwitz around 11:30. Also get to some of your texts to 590-590 if you want to send those in. There is a daily text or DM I get about Joey Votto. There is no Joey Votto update. He has tweeted out that he's had, you know, setback with the ankle. We knew from Ross Atkins that he had a setback being sick as well. Still hasn't gotten into game action. So, I mean, we'll update you as soon as we have updates on that. But for right now, it's been 2.5 months of Joey Votto trying to rehab that ankle, get back to swinging, fielding, running, that kind of thing. So, yes, appreciate all those questions. You can keep them coming to 590, 590. This has been your, like, three times a week Joey Votto non-update. The Jays got Chad Green back yesterday. It's also, should note, Bowden Francis got into his fourth rehab appearance with AAA Buffalo. He threw 3 2/3 innings, threw 60 pitches. The velocity was down a little bit, but for the most part, he's been really good. He threw all three of his breakers yesterday. Over his four rehab appearances, he's at 10 1/3 innings, 11-2 strikeout to walk ratio, only 2 earned runs allowed, a couple unearned with the defense behind him. But yeah, he's been really good. He looks like a guy who they're just kind of spinning their tires, waiting for a need for a long man to open up in the bullpen. At this point, I think, you know, with an off day Thursday and the Pirates series this weekend, you're probably looking at activating him for that Pirates series, depending on how today goes. I mentioned we played in some dead Kennedys that our next guest wouldn't have heard, but he made a tremendous Jackson Holliday in Cambodia joke to me the other day that I thought you should all know about for the, like, four of you who will get it. It's Mike Petriello of MLB.com. He joins us now. A terrific baseball guitar in the background, a luchador and goalie mask-inspired art behind you. You're killing it, man. Good morning.
You know, I'm so happy I came in at the very end of your semi-regular Joey Votto update, because until you said that, I'd sort of forgotten he was a member of the Blue Jays organization. So thank you for the reminder.
You're welcome. He does exist. So I mentioned that Jackson Holliday in Cambodia joke, and we're going to talk some serious statsy stuff here. But you're a big music guy and you're a big baseball guy. Your bandmate in Subway Ghosts is playing songs to Edouard Julien. You know, we've got Alex Fast coming on here saying he's a better bassist than you, etc. There's a lot of overlap between. No, Alex Fast is not a better bassist than you.
You know, we've never really had a bass off. Most bands don't really need competing. Most bands don't need one bass player, much less multiple.
Yeah, that's fair. The last time I saw bands like battling like that, or musicians battling like that, was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And I don't think I don't know if you guys will reach the heights of Sex Bomb. So we'll see. With respect to the music and baseball overlap, though, I play in a longtime fantasy league with some friends. It's a league that is, it also includes like Enosaurus. So there are some competitors in there, but there are some people who have like covered music in the past as well. And there's a rule that your team name has to be a music pun, a music and baseball pun. You made that good Jackson Holliday in Cambodia, Dead Kennedys joke to me the other day. What is like the best one of those that you've come up with over the years for a fantasy team name?
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit that I until this year, didn't really play fantasy for like the last 10 years. And that was mostly because I needed a hobby that wasn't more baseball. But I'm in a league right now. It's not a It's not a music pun, but I am the Funky Muncies, which I think is pretty solid. So what you could turn that, I think, pretty easily into a Beastie Boys pun, right? If you went with the Brass Muncies, that could be kind of cool. So I think that's what I'm going to go with.
Nice, nice. I add a personal rule that it has to be based on someone on my team as well. So I had used Aloy Genius the last couple of years, play on Boy Genius and Aloy Jimenez, obviously. He is not rostered for me this year. I can't imagine he's rostered for very many people this year. Tough start for him. Let's pivot to a team that also got off to a tough start, but the bats have been a little better lately, and that's the Toronto Blue Jays. Mike, you were on Blue Jays Central yesterday, and you kind of highlighted that, yeah, small sample sizes and things like that, but the Blue Jays were 25th in OPS, on base percentage plus slugging percentage, in the first 6-7 weeks of the season. And since May 19th, so we're looking at 10 days here, they have been second. It was 824 going into last night, and then they hit a whole bunch last night. They didn't come through in all those situations with runners on and stuff, but they put up seven again. They got 13 hits and eight walks as a team. The at least OPS-wise and the ability to show an outburst-wise, a couple of nine-run games, a seven-run game, an 11-run game, and a loss. Things have started to turn for the Blue Jays here. Some of this is surely quality of competition, but beyond that, what are you seeing and how the Jays have looked the last 2 weeks or so?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And part of it is as simple as just Vladimir Guerrero Jr. has been better than he was early on. Like, that's a lot of it right there. But if you look at what has been plaguing this team offense-wise for the first 2 months of the season, and now that we've got some of these new metrics to show it, they don't swing hard, right? 30th of 30 teams in bat speed, pretty far down in average exit velocity and all that. And those are things you can't change really in season unless you've got a whole new lineup, right? That's just not something you can go and snap your fingers and say, okay, now we're going to swing harder than anybody. One thing you might be able to change is your approach a little bit. And if you don't swing hard and you don't hit the ball that far, setting aside Vladdy here, obviously, one thing you could try to do is to lean into, let's say, the short porch home runs, right? To pull the ball down the left field line or the right field line, like the David Schneider special, right? Danny Jansen has been wildly leaning into this. And I heard Ross Atkins give an interview the other day where he talked about this a little bit, especially in regards to George Springer, who's obviously not had a good season. And he said, you know, if we want him to get the ball in the air a little bit more, that might be how he gets back up towards the top of the lineup. So when I broke down the good and bad portions of the season yesterday, and you're right, the good portion is like 10 days and there's some good luck in there, I'm sure. The ground ball rate dropped massively. They were middle of the pack and now they've got like the second lowest ground ball rate over the last 10 days. The percentage of pulled fly balls has gone up from 23% to 30%, which gets them towards the top of the league. And that's, I think, a good approach when you're sort of limited in what you can do, right? You're not going to start getting guys who are going to, again, aside from Vladdy, pound the ball to dead center field. That's not the way this team is built. So I like the approach in the sense that maybe you can get the most out of what you have. The only problem with it is it's a little bit boom or bust, right? You go up there and you try to only pop those home runs down the foul line. You're not going to string a lot of rallies together, right? So either that works or it doesn't. Right now it's working. And I guess that's preferable to when, you know, not much of all was working. So it's interesting to see they do appear to have changed what they're trying to do.
Yeah. And look, that's encouraging. We heard, you know, a lot of talk to the extent that fans were tired of hearing it. And we heard a lot last year, you know, some of the underlying stuff. And some of that is like, yeah, there's the flat example of, well, he hits the ball harder than everyone else. We'll expect better results in the future. We have, you know, we can get richer with the data than that and explain some of that gap. But some of the other underlying stuff was, you know, okay, well, we're making really good swing decisions. We're getting into positive counts and things like that. We're just not doing damage when we get there. So maybe this is, you know, a better way for them to do damage and take advantage of that. You know, just pull it in the air. Sometimes an oversimplification, but works pretty well if you're Danny Jansen and you're Dalton Varsho and you're David Schneider. David Schneider, also, you tweeted out the sprite chart of his hits yesterday. He basically hit both foul poles for doubles. Rare there. Obviously speaks to his ability to go both ways with it. But bigger picture, David Schneider now, we're, you know, we've got a decent sample, like a half full season's worth of plate appearances from him. He's sitting at the top of the Blue Jays order now. Where are you in terms of, you know, confidence level that, yeah, what we've seen from David Schneider is real. He's an everyday major league bat. No small sample caveats anymore.
Well, I have an extreme bias towards any player from New Jersey, for one, especially with the mustache. So I got to go with that. You have to play him every day, right? What has he done to prove otherwise? There were questions about his glove, and, you know, he's not an all-star defender or anything like that, but he's competent. He's fine enough in the outfield. I think he's fine enough at second base. He's not going to kill you at those spots. So especially when you look at the rest of the lineup that's been struggling, what argument is there for him to not play every day? Or, you know, no one really plays every day. 9 out of 10 days, right? Everybody gets a day off. That's fine. I know some Blue Jays fans get angsty even when you get that one day off, because I've seen it, right? Nobody plays literally every day outside of, you know, Marcus Semien, right? I don't think he's necessarily this all-star level hitter, like long-term, indefinitely. I think maybe what we saw of him when he first came up last year raised some expectations a little bit beyond what's reasonable. And obviously he fell back a little bit after that. But he has proven pretty conclusively to me that he is an above average major league hitter, like someone who should be not your best hitter probably on a championship team, right? But could he be the fourth best hitter on a really good team? Yeah, it sure seems like he can be. And if you can have him out there at left field or second base or wherever, and hit him in the top half of the lineup, which, to the Blue Jays' credit, they've been doing, right? They have moved him up. They have moved Springer down. I think for all the heat that the manager gets and the front office gets, some for fair reasons and some not for fair reasons, I think they've handled the lineup part pretty well. And I cannot see a reason why Schneider should not be in there 90% of the time. And he has been recently. So they're doing it right.
Yeah, he has been recently. And that's, you know, kind of why I touch base on it. He has... you know, I think he's tied for sixth now in plate appearances on the team. So, you know, even if you'd prefer that to be, I don't know, fourth or fifth or something like that, like, he's not going to get more plate appearances than Vlad and Bo. Those guys are the guys who don't take days off. But yeah, he's been in there for the most part. So when it comes to what you're seeing with the Blue Jays here, and again, things have turned lately, quality of competition asterisk. There are some things, like you said, that they're not going to be able to change. They're dead last in bat speed. And another thing you pointed out on Blue Jays Central is that their older players have really struggled. Like, when we're looking at the 30-plus guys, they're 26th in wins above replacement and 27th in weighted runs created plus from their 30-plus guys. So this isn't even a case of, like, baseball-wide, older players are worse. The OPS league-wide is 698 right now for players who are 30 and older, and 699 for players who are 29 and younger. So there's like a dead even split, but the Jays' older players have particularly struggled. Is that something you see as related to the bat speed stuff we've been able to see?
Well, first of all, I should say I hate this conversation just in general, because then you're sort of forced to talk about how guys with incredibly good careers like Justin Turner, George Springer aren't good now, right? Like, that's not fun.
And that, like, 35 years old is old.
Right, exactly right. I'm 42, right? I'm older than all of them. I should be talking about how those people are old. Those are guys who have had very, very good careers. I think there's a certain trend in baseball towards the younger player for a couple of reasons. Obviously, the younger players haven't reached free agency and don't get those big contracts. That's part of it. But, you know, we all talk how often about how fastball velocity keeps going up and up and up and up. And just by the laws of physics, that means the hitter has less of a reaction time. That's a huge part of why strikeouts keep going up or why offense is down right now. And just the way it works is, as you get older, and I can personally attest to this, your reactions start to get a little bit slower. Maybe you start needing glasses, right? Does not mean older players can't be successful. I still think these guys can be successful, but you look across the trend of baseball, the younger guys tend to be faster. You know, they tend to throw harder fastballs, and it's hard to make an argument other than the fact that experience matters and being in a clubhouse matters and all that stuff is totally valuable, why teams wouldn't be sort of trending towards these younger guys. So I think what happens is you need to change your approach maybe as you get a little bit older. What worked when you were 25 is not necessarily what works when you're 35. And I think you're starting to see that with Springer a little bit. Going back to the pull conversation, some of his best years, he was pulling the ball. He was crushing it. And then it seemed like he started to go towards more of an all-fields approach. And maybe now he's kind of go back to that a little bit, even if it's not like the ideal way you might want to hit. It might be what works best for you right now. Justin Turner is obviously someone who's very intelligent about hitting. He's talked about this a lot over the years, like how he turned his career around once he left the Mets for the Dodgers. But yeah, it's hard to be with a slower bat and be successful unless you're going to be like Luis Arraez, right? Unless you're going to be Stephen Kwan. It's not like you have to have bat speed to be a good hitter, but if you don't, you got to be really, really good at other things. And that's a difficult trick to pull off.
It certainly is. And look, these Jays struggles with their older players are exacerbated a little bit by the fact that when we, you know, when we weight it by playing time by plate appearances. They're the fifth oldest team in baseball as well on the position player side. So their older players have struggled, and they're giving them a lot of playing time relative to the rest of the league. This isn't a Jays specific question, but now that we have this bat speed data, I know we only have it for 1 year so far, but how important do you think that could be to us understanding how hitters age and how different, you know, like one of the more difficult things to for like projection systems and things like that is some guys keep it up into their 30s and some guys don't. And, you know, you could have looked at this past year's, you know, Zips projections, for example, and was like, well, Kevin Kiermaier's done, even though he's coming off like the best offensive year he's had in forever. But George Springer, we think we'll get it back. Obviously, those things haven't played out exactly like that, but having access to things like bat speed, seeing if it is a proxy for ability to get a ball in the air to the pull side and things like that, do you think this could be something that, that really helps us figure out how hitters age?
Can you ask me that in 10 years? Can I come back on your show in a decade and then we'll have a decade's worth of data to answer that? I mean, probably, like you said, we have like 10 weeks-ish worth of data right now. So I'll give you a good example with the Blue Jays, right? Justin Turner has one of the slowest bats in baseball right now. Is that because he's 39 years old, or is that just because that's the way he's always performed?
Right.
Maybe he's swinging exactly the way he did when he was having his all-star seasons. I truly don't know. And so it's hard to answer that. I think in the aggregate, yeah, you probably will see it work similar to fastball velocity, right? Where you throw hard in your 20s and then you get into your 30s and it goes down and down and down a little bit. I'm guessing this will probably be the same. But it's just so hard to say. You got guys like Giancarlo Stanton's a good example. And he is, I can't remember exactly, 33-ish thereabouts. Not like having a great year, but he's still atop the bat speed leaderboard by kind of a nice gap. And so here's my question, and I wish I knew the answer, right? Are his issues not really related to bat speed, but are they related to like pitch recognition and all this other stuff? So like, is this the elite bat speed he's always had? Or was he actually even better than this? He was 27 years old. Instead of being like 2 miles ahead of everybody else, was he like 6 miles ahead of everybody else? You know, was he the Aroldis Chapman of bat speed or whatever? Again, I don't know. Would love to know that. But I think this is really the kind of thing where we've learned so much with 2 months worth of data, where I'm so excited to know what we're going to learn with 2 years, with 5 years, with 10 years.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hopefully that is the case, right? Like, hopefully we can figure some of this stuff out, or at least it'll better help us diagnose, you know, hey, is the Turner thing, yeah, is it a bat speed drop? Is it pitch recognition drop? Is it something else? And for the players themselves, I'm sure they can feel it, but it's probably nice to be able to quantify it and get a little bit of, if you're that type of thinker and that type of player, which obviously varies guy to guy and clubhouse to clubhouse. Outside of the Blue Jays, and again, we're going to need more longer term data on this stuff to really see trends and things like that. But you tweeted the other day, like, how cool it's been. You guys put this out 2 weeks ago, and there's just been so much work done on it. So many fan graphs, a baseball prospectus, and MLB.com pieces and stuff like that. Has anything really stood out to you as like, man, that's cool, or man, I'm really curious about that? Like, what is your favorite part of seeing all this roll out so far?
Yeah, just the interesting ways people have taken this data and run with it. So, you know, I hate to name any just because that leaves out like 12 other great research pieces. Yesterday at Fangraphs, Ben Clemens had a really cool one where he looked at whether increased fastball velocities make for worse swings. And it sounds like it does, which is kind of cool, right? You might think that batters speed up their bat to catch up to a fastball, and it's actually kind of the opposite, which I found really fascinating. There's another one too. I don't know if it's been proven out yet, but I've looked into it and some other people looked into it too. So we know for sure that hitters do have a two-strike approach, right? Even though people want to insist that they don't, that nobody cares about striking out now, bat speeds, they go down on two strikes, right? Which sort of shows to me that, yes, they're slowing their bats down in an effort to make contact and not strike out. So that's cool because that, you know, proves one thing. But then if you go a step further, there's kind of another question that opens up, which is that even a good idea? Because it's like, if there's nobody on base or if there's two outs, then the strikeout really doesn't matter. And if that's the case, now you're just giving up on the idea of making good contact. You just might make a different kind of out. So maybe you shouldn't even have a two-strike approach. Maybe you should just still go out there and put on your good swing. And maybe getting to two strikes isn't just about the pitcher, you know, getting ahead of you. Maybe it's now he has convinced you to make a worse version of yourself, which is sort of what the shift did in the first place, too. I find that all that game theory really fascinating. And I think there's a lot more to come on those kinds of questions.
Here's another one. And this was Mike Petriello who wrote about this. Tap yourself on the back. Yeah, handsome, smart. Yeah, all that stuff. You wrote about Ellie De La Cruz having two very different swings, one from the left side, one for the right side. And the answer to this is probably by the time you reach the majors, you're too far. You have too much experience on the right side and the left side versus left and right-handed pitching, respectively. But do you think this kind of thing is something that could, hey, when we're talking about a guy who might give up switch hitting and try to hit from one side or might go back to switch hitting like we've seen guys do in the past, that this could be valuable in that regard? Like, I'm thinking of, like, where would the tipping point be of, like, man, your swing's just too inconsistent or not good enough. Even if you haven't seen a lot of lefty-on-lefty pitching before, you got to give it up from the other side.
Well, I would say, you know, even though this data is new to the public, like I've said before, right, we have like 10 weeks of data. That's what we have, right? That's what you have. The teams have had this for a number of years, right? Some of them for probably almost a decade at this point, not in-game maybe, but like in their labs and all of it. Some of the teams are wildly ahead of some of the other teams. So I'm not sure that this data release changes that so much beyond what they already knew. Maybe some teams didn't have this and are using our numbers, so I don't really know. But it just in terms of looking at switch hitters, like we've long known that there are some guys who are better from one side or the other. Cedric Mullins, I think, is a great example with Baltimore. His career really took off when he gave up the one side because he just realized it wasn't going to work. And so the thing that about this data that was interesting to me, you know, it's getting beyond just hits well from one side, doesn't hit well from the other side. It's what does that look like? What's the shape of the swing? And with Ellie De La Cruz, especially, and also Ketel Marte, they're just two separate people from each side in terms of how hard they swing. Ketel Marte from the one side, I think, would have rated like top 10 in bat speed. And from the other side, he was like 80th or whatever the number would be. That doesn't mean good and bad. Again, it could be like, listen, if from one side you're, I don't know, Kyle Schwarber, and on the other side you're Luis Arraez, that's actually a really interesting and potentially very valuable hitter. It just doesn't always end up working that way. And to your question about should maybe some of these guys give up switch hitting like Mullins did, I thought the same. Like, I've thought that about Ozzie Albies for years, right? And then I saw this really interesting article from last year about Ketel Marte where it's like, I tried. I went to winter ball and I tried, and it lasted for three games because all of a sudden, you know, instead of having like against a righty pitcher, instead of being in the lefty's batter box and knowing what sliders look like, now I'm on the right side and sliders look totally different and I can't do it, and that totally messes me up, and I just went back. And I thought that was really interesting and a good reminder that players are people, not just bat speed numbers, and if you do something to make them less comfortable, that might, you know, eat up all the value you think you're getting by having them hit from the stronger side.
Mike, last one before I let you go here quickly, and we'll talk about this more as the week rolls on and we get more information. I know your colleague Anthony Castrovince just wrote about this at MLB.com, but we found out yesterday that MLB is going to officially integrate Negro League records into the historical database. So, you know, by MLB's own language, Josh Gibson will now hold some MLB records from that 1920 to 1948 range where black players were not allowed to play in Major League Baseball and they were putting up terrific stats of their own. How exciting is that for you guys at MLB.com? Obviously, we had the stats, but this has been a long time coming from a research perspective and from, you know, figuring out how to properly contextualize Negro League history with alongside Major League Baseball history.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more good than bad, right? I don't think that the players and their families who played in the Negro Leagues necessarily needed this to know how great they were, but I do think it helps bring it to a larger baseball audience. As you can imagine, it's a very complicated and passionate question for a lot of reasons. I think I follow a lot of really intelligent black baseball fans on Twitter, and some of them are like, great, there's rules, and some of them are like, no, I hate this sucks. So you can imagine there's a lot of different thoughts and you know, passionate ideals that go into this. The one thing is, you know, you no matter what you do, you can't go back and undo the original wrong, which was that right, they weren't allowed to play in the AL and the NL in the first. You can't do it, right? So then your options are to try to, you know, look at them as saying, well, this was a powerful, strong baseball league that we should remember, or set it to the side. And there's not going to be one answer that satisfies everybody. And I think where I land on it is this. Even though I think a lot of people will look at some of those numbers and say, well, it was a short season and, you know, we don't necessarily have all the records. And I look at it and I say, well, sure. But I also know that the numbers Babe Ruth piled up might have been a little different had he actually been allowed to face the best players of his day, which he was not. So there's not one right answer to this, but I think this comes from a good place of trying to recognize how great those players were, even though they weren't allowed to play in the NL and the AL at the time.
And it's not that hard an exercise if you would look like to look at purely definitionally MLB records, the same way when Aaron Judge was chasing the American League home run record. Nobody had any issue figuring out which records were American League and which records were National League. We're all very capable of contextualizing that stuff when we see it. But a cool day for the history of baseball, cool day for the history of baseball stats as well. Mike Petriello of MLB.com, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Blake. Take care.
Mike Petriello, MLB.com. Again, we'll talk about that more later in the week. Russell Dorsey of Yahoo, who broke that story initially. We're trying to get him on the show to talk about it a little bit more. A lot of baseball historians are very excited about that as well. And yeah, you can go over to MLB and check all that out. It'll now be, you know, a part of the historical, it has been a part of the historical record, but it'll now be a part of the historical record that you don't have to go to a subsection of the site to look up and, you know, take a look at how it compares to Major League Baseball proper, American League and National League records. So cool. And it'll take us some time to properly contextualize that, but a very good day for baseball history and the history of baseball stats. Also a good day to talk to Spencer Horwitz. It is getting close to time where I think we'll maybe see him in the major leagues. That's not reporting. That's just, you know, look at the Jays roster, look at the bench production they've got, look at what Spencer Horwitz is doing down at AAA. I did a piece on him on Blue Jay Central on the weekend about the swing decisions and the on-base ability and how many doubles he's racking up because of the line drive rate and things like that. Buffalo Bisons, also pretty good. 28-24, second in the entire International League in offense. Let's see what's going right down in Buffalo. Let's take a break, and we'll speak to Spencer Horwitz as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is the walk-up music, or at least last time we saw him up here, it was the walk-up music of our next guest, Buffalo Bisons first baseman slash DH slash left fielder slash second baseman slash top 10 in most AAA hitting categories. It's Spencer Horwitz. Spencer, good morning, man. Thanks for doing this.
Good morning. Of course. Thanks for having me. I love that song. I could play that.
I got to ask, how did that come to be the walk-up song? Is it still the walk-up song too?
Yeah, it's still a walk-up song. I've been rocking it since 2022, and how did it come up? I don't know. I think I just kind of heard it one day, and I was like, "That's it."
That's all right. That's a good way to do it. Man, things going pretty well down in Buffalo. You guys got a big win yesterday, two in a row now to stop that mini losing streak you guys were on, and a couple games over 500 overall. How are things feeling down there with this Bisons team?
Yeah, things are good. Definitely an exciting team. Definitely one of the youngest teams I've been a part of here in Buffalo. But I mean, it's loaded with talent, so it's been fun so far, and hopefully we can keep it rolling, like you said.
One of the youngest teams and one of the like most potent offensive teams. You guys are second in runs scored in the International League. A lot of guys with really nice stat lines individually. Does it feel that way? Like, you feel like this is a dangerous team when you guys go out there every game, if you get in a hole, things like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you see it on a pretty nightly basis here. Our 1 through 9 and 1 through 12 with the guys on the bench are pretty talented in the box. And we do a great job, I think, communicating and with our hitting coach, Ryan Long, just kind of preparing before the game. And, yeah, we've turned in some pretty good results so far.
How has the transition been from Matt Hagg, who I know you worked closely with and is now with the Toronto Blue Jays at the major league level, to Ryan Long? Like, I know organizationally a lot of it's probably the same, like, philosophy and approach and stuff like that, but it's a different guy you're kind of working closely with every day.
Yeah, like you said, I've had Hagg the last 2 years, and I've built a great relationship with him, and he's been awesome up there so far, and yeah, and Ryan's an awesome guy, and I think that's kind of what it boils down to, is we're starting to build that relationship even more. We're about, 6 weeks into the season, almost 2 months now, and yeah, guys are starting to build that trust and grow that relationship with him, just like we had with Hagg, and you can see it's showing on the field.
So a lot of you guys are having nice offensive seasons. Aurelvis Martinez is, you know, the guy who grabs the headline sometimes because he's got 13 home runs. Just how impressive is that power when you see it up close in BP or in games?
Yeah, I've been playing with Aurelvis for the last 3 years, and the power, it's always been there. And when people talk about it, I don't think they really appreciate it until they see it. And we saw it last night. I think he hit one 115, 114, something like that. And that's just another day for Aurelvis. But yeah, he's a really, really special hitter.
Yeah, it's a lot of pop for sure. I want to talk about your own season as well, and kind of the thing I've been focused on here most in Toronto is you pop up in the box score sometimes, or I tune in a game and I'm like, man, Spencer Hordes is at second base. You have played primarily first base and DH through the minors. I know you've had the odd game in left field or second base, but that's now more regular for you. How has that kind of transition or trying to pick up that second base position been going for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It's a new challenge, new opportunity. And I've been working with our infield coach here, Donnie Murphy, and Casey Kandel too. And those guys are really smart, and getting help from the guys too that have been playing it for the last years of pro ball. And they're helping me as much as anyone. And yeah, I'm enjoying it. I think it's going pretty well. Just talking with the Blue Jays is just another opportunity to get my bat in the lineup. And that's what we're looking for.
When you say talking to the Blue Jays, is that, you know, looking ahead? And I know you got to focus on the Bisons day to day, but looking ahead to, you know, potential ways you would get into a major league lineup as well, having that little bit of versatility helps?
Major league and minor league. Our lineup here is special too. And they, the Blue Jays obviously value versatility a lot. So yeah, if I can do it here, hopefully it can show up in the big leagues as well.
What has been, which, if any, of those positions has been tougher to pick up? Because I imagine, you know, second base is more of like a quick reaction speed, but you're on the same side of the diamond. You've seen a lot of balls hit to that side of the diamond versus, you know, left field, you're on the other side, and you're playing outfield position versus an infield position. Has one come to you a little more smoothly than the other?
I think second base comes more smoothly. Okay. I grew up as a shortstop. I mean, I've been an infielder my whole life. And, yeah, I mean, like you said, being on the same side of the diamond, it's that angle of seeing it off the bat. It's just a little more familiarity and more comfortable. But, yeah, I still think left field is still an option, and still a work in progress.
Well, it's good to see. It's fun to see you doing that in the odd double play get turned, or that you had that really nice play a couple weeks ago where you go into the hole at second and get the out at second base. It's been fun to watch. Your offense has always been fun to watch. This is, you know, your third time third partial season, at least, in AAA. What do you, when you're back there again and you're coming off of such a strong offensive season, what are you focusing on your offensive game?
Getting better. I mean, yeah, I'm not here because for an accident. I'm here to get better. And I obviously didn't have a great showing in spring training. And I think that's part of the reason I am here, is that I didn't show that I was ready to roll. And now I feel like I'm getting back to my old ways and back into myself. And it feels good just to get back to work and be healthy and just grinding away and trying to grow as a player and as a person.
Obviously the thing that stands out, you know, when we watch you, when we look at the underlying stats and things like that, is your on-base ability, you know, an on-base percentage up around 440. I can look at some of those kind of StatCast-y stats for the International League and see you near the top of the league in, you know, not chasing outside the zone, not swinging, missing, making good decisions on those pitches on the edges of the zone. What do you attribute that to? Because I know, like, drawing a walk and working good counts and things like that has always been a strength of yours. Where do you think that comes from for you?
I think it's part of that little brother mentality. And what I mean by that is not going to let your older brother beat you. And I grew up with my older brother, obviously, as my best friend. And we competed in everything we did, and I always was smaller and had to play up 3 years, like, to play with him. So yeah, it's just that competitiveness. And then it kind of evolved into my training and making my training as hard as possible. And when you train harder than the game typically is, then it usually works out pretty well.
What does that look like when you say train as hard as possible or train in conditions that are, you know, even more difficult than the game? What does that look like?
In terms of hitting, I'd say it's doing a lot of machine work. And then doing some mixed BP when I don't know what's coming. It's not just when people think of batting practice, that's standard arm BP. It's doing machine, it's doing off speed, it's doing one off speed, one fastball, and it's just really pushing yourself.
So you do obviously have developed a good eye, a sharp eye at that stuff around the edges of the strike zone. Have you enjoyed the automatic system or the challenge system that's rolled out in AAA the last year and a half?
Yeah, I love the challenge system. I think it'd be great in the big leagues. It's obviously hitter friendly, and I think there's still some adjustments that need to be made with it. But it's nice to have a defined zone, and the umpires at the big league level are the best in the world, but they still make errors, and that's what happens. But with the ABS, it takes out human error, and I think that's part of the best part. And when you have these guys throwing 98 to 102 every night, it's kind of unfair if they're getting 3-4 inches off the plate.
Yeah, that's the, you know, this is why the challenge system is good. Get the really egregious ones out of here. Mm-hmm. Maybe the egregious ones are going to keep retiring like they did this week. Okay, so the other component of this is, you know, you work better counts, you're selective at the edges of the plate. That, in theory, should allow you to take kind of your best swings a little bit more often. And this season, there's been a big spike for you in line drive rate. And we can look, I don't know how much you look at or have your own internal versions of like sweet spots percentage or how often you square the ball up or whatever, but you're near the very top of the league in that as well. Is that basically what it comes down to, is you've done a good job and an even better job, you know, making sure what you do swing at is something you can really put on a line?
Exactly. I mean, yeah, people always are quick to complain about my lack of power, but I think doubles are power too. And people just want home runs because that's where baseball is right now. But there's different ways of slugging, and it's not just light power. And I think, yeah, like you said, I'm trying to get into good counts. And when I get into good counts, just taking a good swing at the ball and you square it up. And I don't know. The whole home run craze isn't my game. I guess I'm a little old school with that. But, yeah, I've never heard someone complain about a line drive.
Yeah, or, you know, it's two home runs, but it's 17 doubles as well. You're sitting in scoring position pretty often there. So Spencer, you got two quick call-ups in the majors last year, the September one and then one a little earlier in the season. How did those 15 games you got into kind of help you as you headed into the offseason and headed into this season in terms of like what you needed to work on or just, you know, knowing what to expect if you get that call again?
Yeah, baseball is a game of learning and developing and growing, and the only way you're going to do that is through different experiences. And I was lucky enough to have some really cool ones last year, starting, I think, back in the WBC and playing Miami against the Dominican and Puerto Rico and Nicaragua, Venezuela. That helped me a lot for my debut. And then when I debuted, I was prepared for that. And then after my debut and going back down, I was ready for that September call-up and ready to contribute to a playoff push. I think this year, it's kind of like that, the goals have evolved, and it's not just, oh, I want to debut. Now it's when I want to help this team more consistently. And yeah, it might not have happened the first month of the season, but it could happen anytime, I guess. And as long as I keep doing my thing, and that's all I can really control.
You guys as a group at AAA, because it's not just you that, you know, has a stat line that says, hey, this guy, you know, maybe is ready for a major league shot. There are a couple other guys there as well, and I'm sure you guys are close. How do you guys kind of manage that, you know, not keeping too close an eye on the majors? You're keeping each other kind of accountable and locked in on the Buffalo Bisons, you know, even though obviously you're human, you can't not think about potentially getting mm-hmm. the call to the majors.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard at times. Like, Addison got to debut this year, and he was ecstatic, and we were all ecstatic for him. But yeah, he comes here, and then now he's even hungrier to get back, and I know that exact feeling because it happened to me and with Nathan Lukes too, guys that have gone up and down, and you get that hunger and you get that drive, you get a taste of it, and you just want it more and more. And, we look at the Blue Jays and we're rooting and nothing but hoping for nothing but the best for them. But at the same time, yeah, we want to be there. It's our dream to play in the big leagues. And the only way we can do that is if we take care of what we need to do here. And I think we all understand that, we can daydream and just think about the big leagues all we want, but that's just going to take away from where we are right now. And I think we've done a good job of creating a pretty strong culture of competing and not trying to worry too much about things that aren't in our control.
That makes sense. And it sounds hard to do, but I'm glad you guys are finding a way to do it. How this is more on a personal level than a like Buffalo Bisons level necessarily, but I know you're very, very close with Davis Schneider and Ernie Clement, who are up in the majors, and Davis is now leading off, or Ernie's stuck around for the entire season so far. How cool has that been for you as a friend to see those guys have the success at the next level?
It's awesome. I was talking to Davis, I think it was 2 days ago. We were just on FaceTime, just catching up. We hadn't talked in a little bit. And yeah, I'm his number one fan. I mean, maybe besides his dad and his sisters, but yeah, I'm rooting for him more than anyone. And to see him, I think yesterday he had 3 hits. Yeah. And yeah, I'm always checking the box scores and texting him, and he's texting me. He's doing the same thing, checking the box scores, and Ernie too. And we just, yeah, I mean, it's great to see those guys that you've grinded with to be doing what you know they are capable of and have that opportunity to.
All right. Last one before I let you go here, Spencer. I was doing obviously research for this, and I didn't know this. I assume every player who gets to the, you know, the major league level is a pretty good athlete, but you were a pretty good hockey player too. Is that right?
I was okay. Yeah. I enjoyed skating a lot.
That's great. That's obviously a nice Toronto tie and a nice Buffalo tie in. For you as well. I know things haven't gone well for either of those NHL teams lately, but are you a fan? Like, have you gotten into the Sabres or the Leafs at all?
I've been a big Capitals fan my whole life. So I still root for the Capitals, and they had a short postseason run this year. But I would love to get to a Maple Leafs game one time. But yeah, I went to a bunch of Sabres games when they were still in town. And yeah, it's awesome. I love hockey. I know Toronto, people call it a hockey town. I'd say it's a baseball town still, but it's awesome. I love the sport of hockey. It's so different than baseball, but a lot of similarities. And it's just the fast pace, the physicality of it. It's a unique sport.
Well, Caps fan potentially in Toronto. We'll have to take a look at the Ovechkin's maybe his final season next year. We'll have to take a look at how those dates line up. Spencer, man, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. Hope to see you up here soon.
Of course, appreciate it.
Spencer Horwitz of the Buffalo Bisons, just a monster stat line down there. And yeah, I like he pointed out, people sometimes look at the 2 home runs, still second on the team with 30 RBI, first in the entire organizational system with 17 doubles, has walked almost as many times as he struck out, has 877 OPS there, and has even stole a couple bases. I should have asked him about that. 3 stolen bases for a first baseman is not all that common. So we're going to take some of your texts to round out the show today. You can always text those in to 590-590. It's Alek Manoah against Chris Flexen tonight. We've talked a lot about Manoah. We'll talk about him a lot tomorrow. Curious to see how the changeup plays today. It had looked solid in the Minnesota and Tampa Bay games. It looked less solid against Detroit. He's going to need that pitch to be able to neutralize lefties, because we've seen, even when Alek Manoah was very, very good a couple years back, teams would stack lefties against him, try to take advantage of that platoon advantage. And that is something that a changeup can help you neutralize. And the reason for that is, you know, changeup generally as a righty will play a little better to lefties, just the way it comes out of the hand and the way a left-handed hitter can see it. Whereas the slider, which is, you know, Manoah's best swing and miss pitch, that is one of the pitches that has one of the biggest platoon splits. So a lefty getting to see that coming in out of a right-hander's hand and toward them, they have a little better a time with it than a right-hander would, where they're trying to pick it up a little later and have a little less space visually for that ball to cross. So it'd be interesting to see. Obviously, the two-seamer, his sinker, is his most important pitch in the zone for generating weak contact, getting strikes and things like that. But curious to see how the changeup looks today. I have a couple texts in the text line to close it out here. James in Scotland yesterday DM'd me and said, the team are Jekyll and Hyde, maybe more just Hyde right now, but what 3 underlying indicators should give us optimism for the next 6 to 8 weeks that we can get back on track before the trade deadline, if there are any? James, there aren't, you know, this isn't a case like the 2015 team necessarily, where they're hanging around 500 and you have this huge positive run differential, and Alex Anthopoulos has, you know, told Blair and Barker recently, like, yeah, that's something we looked at. We were outscoring teams like crazy. We were just a little unlucky in close games or the way that those runs got sequenced together or whatever. There was a real underlying case that team was better. This team doesn't have that necessarily. They're right around 21st or 22nd in the league in run differential. The offense has turned in the right direction of late. how much of that is the quality of competition, not something we can really control for all that well. But the Jays did have, you know, in the metrics we can use to control for quality of pitching competition, they were on the more difficult end to start the season. That doesn't make me feel all that great because the schedule is going to turn tough again. And if you make it to the playoffs, the pitching is going to be really good. So you kind of got to get it done no matter what. In terms of underlying things, though, you would look at the talent level historically of Vlad and Bo. You know, even guys like David Schneider, Danny Jansen, Dalton Varsho, who, yes, while they have their ups and downs, we can take a look at what is probably a pretty reasonable expectation from here. And you've got five or six hitters that, yeah, you think can be in there every day and be productive. I wish that that applied to the entire roster. I don't know that some of the guys having lesser seasons are going to come back to the level we expect or you know, a new baseline that's high enough. And then, yeah, I'd say the other big thing, and this isn't exactly giving you three underlying factors, but the rotation is really good. It's I know they haven't been quite the level of last year. I believe they're 11th in starter ERA so far. You know, if Manoah can get back to being a number five type, a high mid-fours ERA guy, that would be big. But they still have Gausman, Berríos, Bassett, and Kikuchi, and that's going to take you pretty far over a span of 162 games. Rick asks, is Swanson going to be around the team but maybe go down a couple times for an outing? No, this is a straight option. I don't think it's a Manoah situation like where when he was on the aisle doing rehab assignments, he would come back up and do his work in between starts. I think Swanson is like option down and will be used like a regular reliever there, not like a guy who's rehabbing and has everything scheduled out very far in advance and things like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but my read on it was that's a pure option to the minors. Robert and Whippy asks if a minor league stint could help Alejandro Kirk. Maybe. I mean, it could help anyone theoretically, but the Blue Jays don't have anyone you could call up in his place. Brian Severn is not, you know, you'd be worse off in the games that Severn is starting instead of Alejandro Kirk. The Jays also really, really like Alejandro Kirk's defense. So while the offense isn't where it's needed to be so far this year, the Jays would tell you if he's starting just once a series, the value of, you know, look at the history of baseball and backup catchers. There have been a lot of defense first guys who teams really, really value. Jeff Mathis, a Caleb Joseph. If Alejandro Kirk can continue to do the defensive things and be a good game caller for the starting rotation, they'll let him work through the offensive struggles at the major league level. I'm fairly sure. Veronica from Toronto says, on the music baseball pun fantasy team names, she went with the Lizzo-inspired 100% that Bichette. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Mine this year is an extremely niche pop punk one that nobody will get, so we'll just leave it for today. Al from Niagara, just looking ahead, how highly do you think the possibility is that the Jays finally DFA Daniel Vogelbach and call up Spencer Horwitz? In terms of how high the possibility is, I don't know. Honestly, I would have thought it happened by now. I thought with the Vogelbach signing, it was intended to be a shorter, you know, a shorter audition because Daniel Vogelbach in his career has been really good at times, but for the most part has hovered around, you know, kind of being a league average bat. And when you're a positionless guy who needs to be pinch run for and things like that, and you're a lefty, you know, it's hard to find regular playing time for that guy. So I didn't think, you know, we had also heard potentially Daniel Vogelbach had signed a 45-day advance consent, which would have meant, you know, this is getting into the CBA minutia, but it would have meant that by May 11th or so, the Jays could have outrighted him to AAA without his whole salary guaranteeing. Anyway, I was a little surprised to see him continue to get that opportunity. At this point, I'm guessing that they see more in the underlying stuff and they really value him as a clubhouse presence. He's a really well-liked guy, a good room guy, and I know that doesn't do a lot when the team's not hitting, but it is a factor that they weigh into these decisions, and I think is something that made it harder for the Swanson option to happen as well. Having said that, the on merit, yeah, Spencer Horwitz or, you know, pick your guy, Addison Barger back up or Nathan Lucas for the defensive versatility and pinch running, whatever. There are guys in AAA who on merit deserve a chance and offer a little bit more flexibility, so I think we'll see it sooner or later. I don't have a timeline on you on that for you, though. Jake H. from Thornhill says, Jays need McMahon. I don't mind giving up a lot for him. Always been a fan since I'm from Denver. That's cool. Yeah, Brian McMahon's. I know our pal Chris Black, who comes on the show a lot, really liked Brian McMahon as an offseason target. I think it was Ben Nicholson-Smith liked him last trade deadline. There is a lot of money owed to Ryan McMahon still, but you don't really need, I mean, the Jays are like seventh or eighth in payroll. They're into the competitive balance tax already. If the season is flittering away, I don't know that they're going to pinch pennies to try to save it. If they can get Ryan McMahon and the prospect price is decent, I think that's something they'd explore. And John Morosi telling us earlier that the Jays are interested in a guy like Ryan McMahon. Last one for today, Joe from Brandon, and this one was from last week, so apologies, Joe, but it's a positive Manoah one. I'm excited to see Manoah going forward rest of the season. I believe he's starting to trend upward again, and hopefully between him and Kevin Gausman, I think they can finally have that good 1-2 starter. If the bats can start getting hot again, it could be a good summer. Now, Joe from Brandon, Manitoba sent that before the weekend series. Alek Manoah had a rough start in that one, and the Blue Jays obviously dropped 3-4 to the Tigers. But the sentiment still exists. The Jays have been better. In fact, the Jays have been the number two offense over the last 10 days. Yes, against the White Sox, Tigers, White Sox with a little bit of Rays sprinkled in there. But you take the positive signs you can. You take things moving in the right direction while you can. That doesn't make you any more confident when Baltimore rolls in here on June 3rd that it's going to go better. But it's what you can do for right now while you're playing the White Sox. 7:40 tonight, they'll play the White Sox once again. It's Alek Manoah against Chris Flexen. It'll be Danjo and Hazel on TV for you again. It'll be Jamie and Caleb for you on Blue Jay Central. I'll join them to talk a little bit more about Chris Flexen as well. Ben Shulman and Chris LaRue on the radio for you, and Shai Davidi down in Chicago writing for us at .ca. Thank you to Caleb McGrath, John Morosi, Mike Petriello, and Spencer Horwitz for coming on the show today. Thanks to Amit Mann, Lance Kennedy, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker have you 4-6. And for Jays Talk postgame, we will be back to break down a potential sweep at 10 a.m. tomorrow.